Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. You've been hearing about it all weekend. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt and the Trump administration set the stage for repealing the Clean Power Plan. It's central to America's quest to reduce carbon emissions under the Obama administration. How did we get here? Who is Scott Pruitt? What's happening inside the EPA? A new frontline looks at the war on the EPA. Joining us now from Boston is producer James Jacoby. Welcome back to In the Moment.
Thank you so much.
I'm guessing you've had a busy day with all the national news sort of coming at the exact time that, this new front line will appear on PBS.
Absolutely. We are in the midst of rejiggering a little bit of the documentary to reflect today's news.
Right. Let's look back before we look forward and go back into the Obama administration to set the stage. Where do you want to begin with, when does the Obama administration really make reducing emissions and addressing climate change a central focus? And then we'll talk about the response to that focus.
Sure. So right out of the gate, basically, the Obama administration signaled that it wanted to do something to curb emissions and of CO2 and do something about climate change. But we were in the midst of the fallout from the financial crisis. And it really wasn't a major priority in the first term. And the president was really hoping that Congress at the time in his first term would deal with it, passing a cap and trade bill and actually taking legislative action. But that didn't happen. And in the meantime, the EPA was kind of pushing the energy sector with a number of new regulations that weren't climate change related per se, but were about air pollution and water pollution that affected the energy sector. And the fear from the energy sector was that during the second Obama term, if there was going to be one, would be that the president would take an executive authority stance and do something, which he did do, and it was the Clean Power Plan that has just been repealed today.
What's the historic role of the EPA? Because much of this, in the end, is about what states are calling overreach. What's the role? What's their job?
Well, the EPA was created in the early 70s. It was created by Richard Nixon, and there was great bipartisan approval for the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. And basically, it was the states themselves were not good enough regulators to keep pollution under control, especially industrial pollution. And they just didn't have the power to do it. And of course, pollution travels across state lines. So there needed to be a federal response to what were state issues. And so there was widespread support for a kind of, they call it cooperative federalism model, a cooperative model between the federal government helping the states to implement federal clean air and clean water laws and regulations. And so this overreach argument that Scott Pruitt has espoused since he was an attorney general in Oklahoma is an interesting argument, claiming that basically that the federal government has overreached its authority to impose on the states plans like the Clean Power Plan, as opposed to work with them cooperatively to do so.
Let's talk about Americans for Prosperity. And as the Obama administration pushes forward, immediately there is a pushback. What does that look like?
Americans for Prosperity was a not-for-profit, kind of called itself a grassroots group that was founded and funded at first by Charles and David Koch, who are two billionaires. Koch Industries was their family company. A lot of the money coming from oil and gas concerns, and they are one of the biggest polluters in the country. And AFP, Americans for Prosperity, was intended to kind of be a free market, fostering the entrepreneurial spirit. And it coincided, of course, with the Tea Party wave in 2009, 2010. And they put out a number of advertisements that were kind of targeted at the potential for taking action on climate change. At the time, It was the cap and trade bill that was proposed in the House and Senate, and so they blanketed a lot of states with different advertisements about how, if passed, any of these bills would raise electricity rates, raise gasoline prices, and be somewhat catastrophic for the economy. And they were very successful in thwarting action in Congress on climate change.
Some of those ads seem comical now. Were they, with the exaggeration and the hyperbole that they employ, ridiculing environmentalists for going to fancy schools, for example, and for not knowing how to, do a hard day's work. They're attacking more than, a specific regulation. They're sort of attacking what?
Well, I think that in the film, it's kind of characterized by the reporter Jane Mayer from The New Yorker, who's done a lot of reporting on the Kochs, as sort of a way to paint the environmental movement as a movement of coastal elites, that it's kind of only coastal elites would be interested in imposing costs on people in the heartland. And it was obviously not an accurate portrayal of the environmental movement, but almost like this caricature. They use an ad, it's called the Carlton ad, and it's of a guy who, with sort of an effete accent, munching on hors d'oeuvres, is talking about how any global warming regulations or legislation that's being considered will, hurt the rest of the country, but it's all in the name of these sort of coastal elite ideals.
All right, so where does Scott Pruitt come from? He's running for Attorney General, and how does his campaign, Attorney General of Oklahoma, how does his campaign differ and sort of tap into this national conversation?
Sure. It was Scott Pruitt had been a minor league baseball team owner in Oklahoma City. He'd been a state representative in the government in Oklahoma. He had been a lawyer who made his name on religious freedom cases in Oklahoma. And he runs for Oklahoma Attorney General in 2000 for the 2010 election. And he ran on a different message. I mean, the traditional Attorney General race is about the traditional AG role, which is kind of being the top cop, the law enforcement, law and order, criminal justice, things of that nature. He ran against Washington. He really ran against the Obama administration, which was rather unique. And it was very much, congruous with the Tea Party message, which is that we need a front line of defense against Obama regulations, Obama-era federal regulations, and that there's major infringements upon states' rights and upon individual liberties, Obamacare being the main thing. But, of course, the EPA, Pruitt talked about it in his campaign and even on election night, said that he would establish an office as soon as he was elected to fight back against all federal encroachment, including the EPA.
This is a fascinating segment. The whole front line is fascinating, of course. But Eric Lipton with the New York Times Pulitzer Prize winning journalist looking into the Republican Attorneys General Association and the amount of money that is changing hands sort of audaciously. Tell us a little bit about that story and whether or not that's just part of the democratic process or whether that's illegal, unethical. Set the stage.
Sure. So Eric Lipton is a terrific investigative journalist at the New York Times, and a few years ago he had published a Pulitzer Prize-winning series about attorneys general, both Democrat and Republican attorneys general. The attorney general on both sides have fundraising organizations that help to elect more either Republican or Democrat attorneys general. RAGA, the Republican Attorneys General Association, took quite a bit of money from the energy industry, and Scott Pruitt was the head of RAGA for a couple of years and was very involved in actually setting up a dark money part of RAGA where we don't exactly know who was giving to that. It was called the Rule of Law Defense Fund. And so Lipton at the time was looking into the influx of money to both Republican Attorneys General Association and the Democrats. And his reporting actually started at a RAGA fundraiser in Washington, D.C. at the Park Hyatt Hotel there. And he went to the fundraiser, just walked in unannounced, and sees, as he puts it, literally lobbyists writing checks and handing them to attorneys general. And these are the top law enforcement officials in our states. And was completely astonished by what he saw, and it just began an odyssey for him that eventually led to a major report on Pruitt at the time and his ties to the energy industry, but also on the Democrat side as well.
So how does Scott Pruitt end up in charge of the EPA? Because it seems there's a few strikes against him.
Well, he ends up in charge in part because he led the strike force, really, of attorneys general to push back on Obama-era policies that were seen as the war on coal and the war on fossil fuels. And so for the Trump administration, one of their main campaign promises was that they would end the war on coal, or the so-called war on coal. That was they had very successfully run on that message in various coal and oil and gas producing states and the Rust Belt. And so I think they picked Pruitt in part because he was the first line of defense against the Obama-era policies and was now going to be in charge of undoing them.
And then we have this character, Bob Murray, industry executive, has the ear to President Trump or candidate Trump at some point. What's his role in all this?
So Bob Murray is the head of Murray Energy Corporation, which is the largest private coal company, coal mining company in the country. It's based in Ohio, and Murray is kind of an elder statesman of the coal industry and has been a very vocal, very active critic of the EPA's policies toward coal going back a long time, but especially during the Obama years. And he and Pruitt became linked because as soon as the Clean Power Plan was announced, the final version of the Clean Power Plan, Pruitt joined Bob Murray's lawsuit against the U.S. EPA to try to stop the Clean Power Plan, along with other attorneys general at the time. And he has probably been the number one critic of the Obama-era EPA. And in early May, during the campaign, the presidential campaign, he had been supporting other candidates, but at the time, Trump looked like the front runner. He met with Trump in New York City, was very impressed by him and his concern for coal country, and threw his weight behind him, and has, you know, to some extent, had the president's ear ever since.
He says he has an action plan that he gave to the president, 3-page action plan, and President Trump has cruised through page one at this point. Do you believe that?
I do believe it. You know, one of the things is that all of these Obama-era rules that did target the coal industry or the coal-burning utilities are now in the process of being reviewed and in some cases repealed. So, you know, Murray shared an interesting anecdote with us. One rule that didn't have to go through a formal repeal process because it was a new rule that was less, I think, than 60 or 90 days old. It was called the Stream Protection Rule that the Trump administration very early on rolled back and didn't have to go through a formal process to do so. Trump invited Murray and some of his miners to the Oval Office to undo the rule and do the signing. And Murray tells the story about how his miners left their boot marks on the carpet of the Oval Office, and it was a kind of crowning achievement for him. Mm-hmm. And a number of other rules that are a little bit more obscure than something like the Clean Power Plan are in the midst of being reviewed and in some cases suspended or repealed. Those don't get as much press, but they're in some cases really important rules in terms of water quality and air quality.
Could the Obama administration and President Barack Obama himself done things differently You know, he sort of set the tone at his second inauguration speech. Some people found that to be alarmist. Was he incapable of negotiating with Congress or getting things through Congress? What is there anything, you know, at this point that you can look back and say, this was a misstep by the Obama administration? So to set the stage for the sort of divisiveness that we have.
Yeah, well, we talked earlier about Americans for Prosperity and the fact that, you know, there was a strong movement after the 2010 election to basically, in Congress, to take climate change action off the table. And that is where the Obama administration had hoped action would take place. Kind of move by the people's Congress to do something about climate change. That did not happen. And so coming into his second term, Obama had faced all this recalcitrance from Congress and really decided that he needed to move. And he did so through executive authority. And that really did, for lack of a better term, it really pissed off his political opponents and kind of, as it was put to us, really sent people to their polls because they saw it as an executive overreach. If Congress wasn't going to do it, then the executive shouldn't do it. And so, there is some look back too bold an action, and Gina McCarthy, the former administrator of the EPA during the second Obama term, she talks about kind of looking back whether there's anything they could have done differently. But I think that the way that they see it is that they weren't not going to take action, and so they did their best to push forward something that they saw as reasonable on climate change, and it also helped them get into the Paris Agreement and to bring other countries into the fold, because the U.S. for the first time had taken steps to reduce emissions from power plants and to curb carbon emissions. So it's an open question, and it's an interesting one, about whether they could have been more mild in their approach and that wouldn't have had such a backlash. But it in some ways they were boxed in. If this was a priority of theirs and they wanted to move forward, they couldn't do anything in Congress, and they felt like they had to go the executive authority route.
What happens to the Clean Power Plan as far as all the litigation? Will the Supreme Court ever rule on what is overreach from the EPA or is not, now that it's set to be repealed by the Trump administration? Will we ever get a legal opinion on whether or not the EPA was stretching, or whether it really was overreach?
I don't believe legally. We will. I think that what happened was the Supreme Court had issued a stay. The case had been argued in the circuit court in D.C., and before the D.C. Circuit ruled on the merits of the case, that was Bob Murray and Scott Pruitt's lawsuit against the EPA. Before the circuit court ruled, in a totally unprecedented move, the U.S. Supreme Court basically put a stop to the plan. There was no decision that was made until the Trump administration came in. And now that there's been, the initial move back when they came into office to review the plan and now to repeal it, I don't believe that there will be a decision that's made on the merits of the case. So what will happen going forward is that there'll be legal cases to stop this repeal. But it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
And the argument is the EPA is not living up to its legal responsibility to regulate and keep the citizens' health and safety in mind. That's the
correct
argument. Yes. So different.
Well, the argument is that the EPA, the Supreme Court ordered in another case, ordered the EPA to regulate carbon and greenhouse gases if, in fact, it found that it posed a threat to human health and the environment. The EPA in 2009 found and decided that carbon pollution was, in fact, a threat to human health and the environment, and is under an obligation by law to do something about it. So by repealing the Clean Power Plan, the EPA still is under the law, needs to regulate carbon pollution in some way or another.
Conversation's not over by a stretch.
No, it is not.
James Jacoby is producer for Frontline's War on the EPA. You can see it on SDPB TV Wednesday night, 9 Central, 8 Mountain. James Jacoby joined us from Boston. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.